This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
They definitely knew what they were doing. When you're trying to control the emissions in a car, particularly a diesel, there's all sorts of trade-offs. You can have less nitrogen oxides, which are quite poisonous, but then you tend to create more particles, which cause cancer. And if you control all of those things, you may hurt the fuel economy, which means more carbon dioxide.
When a West Virginia University research team won a grant in 2012 to run some tests on diesel cars, they could not have imagined that their relatively small study would soon be bringing one of the largest, most storied automakers in the world to its knees. Something in the Farfignugan just didn't smell right. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to New York Times reporter Jack Ewing, whose new book, Faster, Higher, Farther, takes a deep plunge into the history of Volkswagen and gives us the latest on the company's emissions scandal. We learn about the Nazi propaganda beginnings of Volkswagen, the company's involvement in wartime atrocities, and the powerful families behind the Volkswagen brand. We also examine the company's systematic and dishonest emissions cheating practices and talk about what lies ahead for the auto giant. I'm joined now by Jack Ewing. He's a New York Times reporter, and his latest book is on Volkswagen. It's called Faster, Higher, Farther. Jack, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks very much for having me.
So you've been at the forefront of covering this scandal. Why don't you first tell us how long you've been in Germany working for the Times, and give us kind of your personal relationship to this scandal before we dive into it.
Well, actually, I've been in Germany for more than 20 years. I used to work for Business Week magazine, and then in 2010, I switched to the New York Times. And I've always, off and on, covered the car industry, which is, you know, a very big industry here in Germany. And then when the scandal broke in September 2015, it was natural for me to cover it because that was part of my beat. And so right away, it was a big story for me.
So why don't you first give a quick, if we can, recap of where we are right now. A lot of people have heard of the Volkswagen emissions scandals, but things have kind of been laying low in the news with the world exploding on so many other fronts. People haven't been as focused, perhaps, on what's going on in the world of Volkswagen.
Okay. Well, right now, I mean, the status is that Volkswagen is in the process of buying back cars in the United States. That was part of a legal settlement worked out at the end of last year. The whole thing's costing Volkswagen more than $22 billion in the United States. They've also recently pleaded guilty to criminal charges in the United States and agreed to pay $4.3 billion in fines and civil penalties. That's part of that $22 billion. And meanwhile, there's ongoing criminal investigations in the United States, in Germany, and some other countries. Six executives have been indicted by the U.S. authorities. One is in custody in Detroit. The others are in Germany. So I think that's the next big thing that we're waiting for, is to see where these criminal proceedings lead and, you know, which individuals were responsible and how high up did it go in the company.
And that $22 billion, is that U.S. payments alone? It hasn't really come down in Europe yet, right?
Right. It's the U.S. legal system is much more conducive to claims by owners. Most European countries don't have class action lawsuits, so you have to sue Volkswagen as an individual to get your money back. So it's tougher in Europe, but there are a lot of claims by individuals, and people are trying to find creative ways to group together. There is a class action suit in Britain, which has a form of class action. And then there's suits by shareholders which could also be very expensive for Volkswagen, basically accusing the management of not fulfilling their duties. And those could lead to maybe another $10 billion in Europe. And then there's also proceedings in a number of other countries outside of Europe. South Korea had a criminal case, and there's a few others, although it's mostly in Europe.
So let's take a step back just a little bit before we dive into the real deep history of this company and then the auto industry in Germany. Let's focus on some students from West Virginia University and what they unwittingly stumbled upon.
Yeah, well, they had a grant, a $70,000 grant. There's a team at West Virginia. There's a Center for the Study of Emissions that's well-established. It's been operating for several decades. Not widely known to the public, of course, but within the industry, it has a very good reputation. And in 2013, they got a $70,000 grant from a nonprofit organization called the International Council on Clean Transportation. And they very simply wanted to find out how the German automakers were meeting emission standards in the U.S., which are stricter than in Europe. It was seen, I think, as a pretty simple research project, not a lot of money. It was handled mostly by some graduate students under the supervision of a guy named Dan Carter, who runs this emission center. And they had rigged up systems for testing the cars on the road, which was the novel part of their research, because typically emissions are tested in a garage. And they took these cars out on the road with this kind of very complicated apparatus on the backs of the cars, sucking exhaust out of the tailpipe and analyzing it, and quickly realized that there was something strange about the Volkswagen emissions, because they were much higher out on the road than they were when they were tested in the labs.
And then the fallout from this reverberated across the globe. Why don't you walk us through what happened?
Right. Well, with the people from West Virginia published a study, and they didn't they couldn't really explain why there was a big difference between the road and the laboratory emissions. And as we now know, the explanation was that Volkswagen had built software into the engines that recognized when the cars were being tested in a garage and cranked up the emissions controls so that they were compliant. And then when the cars were out on the road, the emission controls were dialed way down to protect the equipment, which would have otherwise worn out prematurely and used and caused the car to get worse fuel mileage. So, but the people at West Virginia didn't know that at first. They published their study, presented it at a conference in San Diego in early 2014, and people from Volkswagen noticed it and immediately caused alarm bells to go off within the company. And the other people who noticed were the officials from the California Air Resources Board, which, as you know, is the clean air enforcer in California. And the California officials then started a much more extensive research project than the West Virginia students had had the resources for, tested quite a large number of cars, trying to figure out what was going on, because they knew that these cars were polluting more than they should be. And Volkswagen then mounted a very extensive cover-up, which lasted basically a year and a half. But to the credit of the car people, they stuck with it and eventually cornered the Volkswagen people, who in September 2015 confessed that they had this illegal software in the cars, and that's when the whole thing blew up and became public.
Why did Volkswagen not do their own emissions road tests for their vehicles? Was it because they had the software in place, or was that industry standard?
That was the industry standard. I mean, the regulators didn't test the cars on the road. They tested them in the labs, and this was something that was the environmental groups had been complaining about for years, because they didn't think that the lab tests necessarily reflected what was going on in the real world. But there was a lot of bureaucratic resistance at the regulators in both Europe and the United States to the road testing. They like laboratories, which are very predictable. You can control all the conditions, the temperature, the atmospheric pressure, and so on. you get out on the road and there's all sorts of variables that you have to correct for. So the industry was totally geared to testing in the laboratory. But as I said, the environmental groups were very concerned that this didn't really reflect how much the cars were polluting. And in fact, if you the measurements in European cities where you have a lot of diesels, the air quality had not gotten it had not improved as much as it should have, given the improvements in emissions technology that had so supposedly been installed in the cars. So yeah, this was the industry standard. There was nothing unusual about that for Volkswagen.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to New York Times reporter Jack Ewing. His latest book is Faster, Higher, Farther. So Jack, let's go way back to the beginnings of the German automotive industry, if you will. And why don't you explain how Volkswagen came on the scene?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't actually know the whole backstory. The Volkswagen actually started as a Nazi propaganda project. When the Nazis took power, hardly any normal people drove cars in Germany. You had to be rich to afford the cars that were available. And in the United States, you had Henry Ford and the Model T, who had made automobile transportation accessible to the middle class. And as a result, U.S. was much more motorized than Germany. And that really annoyed the Nazis. So they said, let's come up with a car that everybody can afford, the Volkswagen, and the people's car. And they built a huge factory to produce it. They had these grandiose plans of how many they were going to make. But they had only made a couple hundred when the war broke out. And the factory was then converted to military production. And it was actually at the only after the war that Volkswagen emerged as a genuine car company, largely thanks to a British major named Ivan Hirst, who was put in charge of the factory by the occupying forces. And he noticed this car standing around, the Beetle, one of the prototypes, and said, you know, what's that? And the British Army at the time was really short of transportation, so he got the workers who were idle, had nothing to do, he got them to start building this car again. And that was really how Volkswagen as a car company got started.
So my first car was a Volkswagen Jetta. And I remember my stepfather, who's very much involved with Holocaust victim reparations, he was not pleased that my first car was a Volkswagen. And he was like, that's a Nazi car. So we kind of skipped over a little bit of the war. You detail it very well in the book. Why don't you explain the seed of my stepfather's antipathy towards Volkswagen. Besides not making cars during the war, they did some pretty heinous stuff.
Yeah, well, your stepfather, the way he felt about Volkswagen was not completely unjustified because, well, pretty much all companies in Germany during the war used forced labor in one form or another. But Volkswagen, because it was so new, it had very few regular workers. So it really depended on forced workers much more than any other large company in Germany during the war. So that ranged from people who were conscripted from occupied countries, but it also included concentration camp inmates, including people from Auschwitz. And they had a camp on the grounds that was overseen by SS guards where the conditions were very brutal. The concentration camp workers were poorly fed. Many of them died. One of the most, I think, heart-wrenching tales to come out of that period was that when babies were born to the forced workers, including the conscripts from Poland and places like that, they were put in a so-called children's home where they were basically allowed to die. and not given food and water and sanitation.
I think you're right that there's 365 babies died from this this practice.
Yes, and so I think that's really one of the darkest chapters in Volkswagen history. The SS doctor who oversaw this facility was executed by the British after the war. And Volkswagen, must be said, did join other German companies in paying reparations much later. But there was also, I think, a reluctance to admit that there was any real culpability by the company management. They wanted to blame it on the Nazis.
But the British really saved the company in some ways. And so why don't you explain how there's this connection between the Porsche family, the Piëch family, and the modern Volkswagen Corporation. Why don't you walk us through kind of the golden era of Volkswagen, if you can?
Sure. The Beetle, when the Nazis decided to, they wanted this Volkswagen, the people's car, they hired a guy named Ferdinand Porsche to design it. And he was really one of the gigantic figures of the early history of the automobile. Was already a very renowned automobile designer at the time. So he designed what later came to be known as the Beetle, a very simple, cheap, easy-to-build car, which became very familiar around the world later on. But as I said, it was not built in great numbers during the war. And then Ferdinand Porsche, the Porsche family, they managed the company during the war. Ferdinand Porsche's son-in-law, Anton Piëch, managed the factory during the war. And this is, of course, when the slave labor was being used. And both Ferdinand Porsche and Anton Piëch, after the war, were held for alleged war crimes, but never charged or convicted of anything. And both died of natural causes fairly soon after the war. But the Porsche family, although they didn't retain ownership of Volkswagen, they did get a royalty from the production of the Beetles for as long as the Beetle was produced. And there was always a close connection between the family and the company Volkswagen. The first Porsche sports cars were actually built on Volkswagen chassis with a souped-up Volkswagen engine. And Porsche always depended on Volkswagen to produce components and sometimes to produce whole cars. So anyways, fast forward to the 90s, Anton Piëch's son, Ferdinand Piëch, he had come up through the ranks at Audi, which is a division of Volkswagen, and he became the chief executive of Volkswagen in the early 1990s. So you have the grandson of the Beetle designer who was then in charge of the company. And Ferdinand Piëch, also without question an automotive genius, but also quite authoritarian, and there was numerous scandals while he was running the company. He turned it around financially, greatly improved the products, but also was criticized for being very ruthless and amoral in the way that he managed the company. And I argue in the book that the culture he created was a critical factor in allowing the scandal to develop.
But he was off the scene by the time it really exploded, correct?
Just a few months before it exploded, he had lost a power struggle with his hand-picked chief executive. He had been chief executive of Volkswagen for about a decade till the early 2000s, and then he became supervisory board chairman, which is a theoretically a part-time oversight position, but he remained a dominant person in the company. And his hand-picked successor, Martin Winterkorn, they had a falling out just a couple of months before the scandal came to light. So Piëch himself was kind of in the background by the time the whole thing exploded, but I think clearly he created the company, the type of atmosphere where this type of wrongdoing could come about.
February morning, my car won't start today. I turn the key at 8:03, the battery passed away on Saturday night. Automobile, I'm running out of time.
automobile I want, automobile I want, that it all ends. Brad's getting married in the springtime, Widow's getting married in the fall. I got married in high school, or I wouldn't have gotten married at all. I'd be driving my automobile, I'd be driving my automobile, I'd be driving my automobile, I'd be driving it all around. Everybody said to the new groom, groom, what you gonna be? I said, I'm gonna be a symphony just as soon as I find a key to my automobile.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jack Ewing. He's a New York Times reporter, and his new book is called Faster, Higher, Farther. It's a history of the Volkswagen scandal. So, Jack, let's get back to the actual emissions problems and the cheating and why, when people think of emissions, they tend to think of carbon dioxide. But this was about nitrogen oxide. Did that surprise Volkswagen, or did they know what they're doing here?
They definitely knew what they were doing. When you're trying to control the emissions in a car, particularly a diesel, there's all sorts of trade-offs. You can have less nitrogen oxides, which are quite poisonous, but then you tend to create more particles, which cause cancer. And if you control all of those things, you may hurt the fuel economy, which means more carbon dioxide. So it is, in fairness to Volkswagen and all the car makers, it's very difficult to make all of these things work at once. They're constant trade-offs. And Volkswagen decided that the thing they were going to sacrifice was nitrogen oxide emissions. And they had programmed the car so that it controlled particles pretty well. It produced less carbon dioxide than a gasoline car, but much more nitrogen oxides, which are responsible for a whole array of health problems and are also the main component of smog in urban areas.
So the Toyota Prius was already making major strides around the globe by the time Volkswagen had decided to go another direction and to really tout its quote-unquote clean diesel technology. Where do you think that stemmed from, Jack?
Well, it was actually Toyota that really took Volkswagen's place as the leading importer in the United States back in the 70s, and had always been the rival that they wanted to go after. And I think the German, not just Volkswagen, all the German car makers were caught off guard by the success of the Prius, the hybrid technology. And they didn't really have an answer for it. They had been investing in diesel, which they thought was superior technology. So Volkswagen's strategy was not only to sell diesel, but they specifically targeted the environmentally conscious buyers, the same people who would also be looking at a Prius. And in fact, I still get emails all the time from people who bought Volkswagens for that reason. And they tell me, I test drove a Prius and I test drove a Jetta and I liked the way the Jetta felt. And I bought it thinking that it was just as clean. And that's one of the reasons why this whole thing has proved to be so expensive for Volkswagen. Is not only did they break the law with this illegal software and cheating, but they also advertised that their cars were clean and environmentally friendly, and that was a lie. So that turned the whole thing not only into a regulatory violation, but a huge consumer fraud. In many ways, that's been more expensive than the illegal software.
But despite this misstep in terms of going towards clean diesel rather than electric cars, and in spite of the cheating scandal, they actually became the world's number one car maker.
It's true. They did become the world's largest car maker. I don't think diesel certainly played a big role in them becoming the market leader in Europe, where they are still totally dominant. They have about a quarter of the total market, which is about twice as much as anybody else. But they were never really able to duplicate that anywhere else. So yes, they met their goal, but just barely. They're basically neck and neck with Toyota to be the largest. They're not nearly as profitable as Toyota or as efficient. So in a lot of ways, they fell short of their goal. And then, of course, the scandal creates, calls into question how powerful they're going to be in the future.
And when you talk about the payments, the $22 billion in the U.S. and something like, you guess, around $10 billion in Europe, could this cripple the company, or do they have enough capital on hand to be able to pay this out?
They have enough money. It's, you know, it's a huge, very powerful company. They have a lot of cash flow. That's not an immediate problem. But I think the big issue is that all of the car companies now have recognized that they have to start making a serious shift to electric cars, and not only electric cars, but self-driving cars, cars that are connected to each other over computer networks. It's really a transformation that's taking place, and that requires a lot of money for research and development. And the companies that come out ahead in this transformation are the ones that have the best technology. And of course, that's this $22 billion is money that Volkswagen really needs to be spending on research and new technologies, not on, on fines and legal settlements. And I see that as the biggest threat to the company by far.
And what do you make of the Republican stranglehold on our political system in the U.S. and touting that they're going to be reducing regulations? And under a Republican-led administration, do you think something like the Volkswagen emissions scandal will be repeated? Is this something that a lot of people wish never happened?
There's certainly, I think there's, well, obviously Volkswagen, they wish it never happened. I think the rest of the industry wishes also that it never happened, because it's now called into question diesels from other companies. Fiat Chrysler has now been sued by the Justice Department, also accused of cheating or of at least of violating regulations with about 100,000 pickups sold in the United States. So it's become, I think, an industry-wide problem and put pressure on the industry to make the shift faster to electric vehicles. But, you know, that's tough for them, and it opens them up to new competitors like Google and Tesla, of course, and then also some of startups like Uber. And so it's kind of a dangerous moment for the car companies. To get back to your question, my editors, the New York Times, don't like me to be a partisan in any way. But what I can say is that, you know, even if you don't care about pollution and you don't care about CO2 emissions, this is a case where environmental regulators caught a company competing unfairly with American companies which were following the rules and trying to get a foothold in the U.S. market by illegal means. And President Trump has specifically singled out Germany as a country that he feels competes unfairly with the United States. So this was a case of that that was uncovered by the California regulators cooperating with the EPA. And if you got those agencies, sure, something like this could happen again, no question.
It's a fascinating read. We'll link to it on Sea Change Radio. The book is Faster, Higher, Farther. Jack Ewing, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks a lot for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Rodney Jones, Bobby McFerrin, and John Prine. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.